From the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, I'm Barbara Caridi, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, September 6, 2016. And on this day, today is the deadline for Maine House members to weigh in on whether they want to return for a special session to consider action on Governor Paul LePage. Congress, meanwhile, is back in session, but not for long, setting the stage for what Maine's delegation expects to be another round of spending battles, and how New England's changing mix of energy sources is challenging the region's electric grid. Those stories and more after this. This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and Kennebec Valley Community College, offering a late start semester beginning September 26th. kvcc.me.edu. I'm Barbara Caridi. Democrats in the Maine legislature continue to exert political pressure on legislative Republicans for opposing an effort to sanction Governor Paul LePage for his obscenity-laced voicemail to a state legislator. A poll of House members found that 84 want to come in for a special session, while 67 said no or refused to respond. What does it mean? Steve Missler has more.
The governor and Republicans say they've moved on from the controversy, but Democrats continue to fan a firestorm that drew sustained national media attention while prompting some elected officials and others to publicly question whether the governor suffers from mental illness or substance abuse. On Tuesday, House Speaker Mark Eaves released the results of a poll of lawmakers who were asked to agree to a special session to punish the governor. The disclosure does not change the mathematical hurdle to call a special session, but it does allow Democrats to accuse Republicans, many of whom did not respond to the survey, of doing nothing to hold LePage accountable. Last week, a bipartisan effort to call a special session sputtered. Republican Senate President Michael Thibodeau accused Democrats of torpedoing the compromise by signaling they would only attempt to impeach the governor. Thibodeau said his caucus, which would be needed to call the session, would not support LePage's ouster, but some could support censure and asking the governor to seek professional help. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Meanwhile, despite vowing to never talk to the media again, Governor LePage made his usual Tuesday appearance this morning on WVOM radio. The governor said he wants to put the events of the last couple of weeks behind him.
I'm moving on, and they need to do what they got to do, and I'm just not going to. I'm out of it. I'm just going to move on.
LePage said he has apologized to Representative Drew Gattine, a Westbrook Democrat, for leaving an obscene voicemail on Gattine's phone. LePage said he's now ready to put the incident behind him. And a 6 to 7 foot high image of Governor Paul LePage dressed in Ku Klux Klan regalia has been spray painted on a wall along a Portland walking trail that's long been used as a place to legally post graffiti. The wall is owned by the Portland Water District. Spokesperson Michelle Clement says about a decade and a half ago, at the request of the city, the district agreed to allow the wall to be used as a sanctioned canvas for graffiti. But she says the agency has not monitored what goes on the wall.
The local graffiti artist community seems to do a pretty good job at keeping that a revolving sort of canvas, so it's always changing.
Clement says the Water District has been in contact with the city of Portland to discuss what, if anything, should be done about the image. She says officials aren't sure if there were any rules or requirements set up 15 years ago when the graffiti wall was sanctioned. In addition to the caricature of the governor, several derogatory comments were also placed on the wall, as well as a call for LePage to be forced from office. And down in Washington, Congress is back at work this week after taking most of the summer off. House and Senate leaders say with only this month planned for the session, they will not complete action on the dozen funding bills that make up the federal budget. And as Mal Leary reports, that could set off a mad scramble to fund a few new high-priority programs.
It's a given that Congress will have to pass a continuing resolution sometime this month to keep the federal government operating. But new spending can't be included. and that means money will have to be found to pay for combating the spread of the Zika virus and to address the nation's drug abuse crisis. Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine, who serves on the Senate Appropriations Committee, says funding for both initiatives should be approved.
It is inexcusable that the Congress adjourned without passing the Zika funding. Every day we learn of a few new cases.
Democratic Congresswoman Shelley Pingree, who serves on the House Appropriations Committee, also believes that Zika funding is critical.
We're seeing more and more of it in Florida. It's spreading. I think it has people very nervous. The administration had some funding that they could tap into, and as I understand, they have.
Pingree says a Zika funding vote was blocked because the House added an amendment that unfunded family planning. Senator Angus King, an independent, says the House has a habit of tacking on non-related issues to legislation, which has blocked progress on funding a lot of problems, including Zika.
And that's what killed it. It would have passed in 5 minutes. And now we're back at messing around with that. I've been agitating during this recess that we ought to go back and do a Zika bill in one day.
Republican Congressman Bruce Poliquin declined to be interviewed for this story, but has voted for Zika funding in the past. He also declined comment on funding for the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act, or CARA, which he has supported. The legislation authorizes several new programs to address the drug crisis, but provided no new dollars. Senator King says CARA should have been funded when it was passed.
Everybody said, well, don't worry, we're going to fund it in appropriations, and that'll be, you know, in the late summer, early fall, and now that's going to be put on hold. In the meantime, we're headed toward another record loss of life here in Maine from overdoses.
Congresswoman Pingree says CARA should have been funded when the bill was passed, but House Republicans, again, wanted to attach unrelated amendments to the legislation that the Senate would not even consider.
If there's one thing that states like Maine need, it's funding. It's funding to, you know, assist the people in need, to fund treatment, law enforcement. And I'm not sure why my Republican colleagues have been so unwilling to put funding behind this.
Senator Collins says while there was some money in existing accounts for both CARA and the Zika outbreak, there is a clear need for additional emergency funding for both, a need that could be met with standalone bills free of extraneous amendments.
Put aside unrelated issues and focus on the crisis at hand.
Collins says she hopes that's what Congress will do, but points out that the entire House and a third of the Senate are up for election in November. She says many of those members seem to be more concerned with their election campaigns than with passing a budget by October 1st. And that could mean tough budget decisions are delayed until after the election or until the first of the year, as some in the House are advocating. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
Coming up, the challenge that changes in New England's energy mix is posing for the region's electric grid. Health officials in Maine say the state's opioid epidemic has likely been a major contributor to a recent rise in reported hepatitis B cases. The Portland Press-Herald reports that the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention has reported 29 cases of active hepatitis B this year through September 1st. In a typical year, Maine has fewer than 10 cases. The state has a rate of 2.2 hepatitis B cases per 100,000 residents so far in 2016. That figure is more than twice the national average for 2014, the latest data available. Maine CDC officials say sharing needles is a major risk factor for the infection, which can cause liver damage. To combat the increase, health officials have advocated for the expansion of needle exchange programs statewide. And an arm of the European Union says there's enough scientific evidence to move forward with a review of Sweden's request to declare the American lobster an invasive species. The opinion of the European Union Scientific Forum on Invasive Alien Species, announced today, sets in motion a broader review of the proposal to ban American lobsters. Lobstermen in the U.S. and Canada stand to lose $200 million in business with EU countries if the ban becomes a reality. They contend a ban is not supported by science. Sweden set the wheels in motion when it announced it had found 32 American lobsters in the country's waters earlier this year and that they pose a threat to native crustaceans. The expanded review won't be completed until the spring at the earliest. And in Portland, an animal health biotech company is asking city residents for a big tax break to help cover a $12 million expansion. Now, Mayor Ethan Strimling says the city should get something extra in return. Fred Bever reports.
Strimling says if the city council wants to award ImmuCell a $375,000 tax increment financing package, or TIF, it should attach a few requirements.
You got to hire locally, you got to train people, and you got to pay them a good wage. This covers the three legs of that stool.
He's proposing to require the project's contractors to meet prevailing wages for the industry and to run a federally certified apprenticeship program. In addition, certain percentages of work hours would have to go to city residents and to protected classes, such as minorities and women, as well as single parents, the homeless, and people on public assistance. ImmuCell President Michael Brigham says the expansion will enable production of a new bovine mastitis treatment. He calls Strimling's proposal admirable, but impractical.
We're now full design and out to bid and actually bids received. So to go back to those contractors now and ask them to essentially rebid because there are different provisions on wages and on diversity and on apprenticeships would cause a delay. And we've got 3 years to go to get this product through to FDA approval, and every month counts.
City Councilor David Brennerman says Strimling's ideas are worthy of debate for future city-assisted projects. But this specific mid-course proposal, he adds, is likely dead on arrival. A public hearing is scheduled for Tuesday evening. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
And a Portland-based air carrier that aims to connect underserved communities with popular destinations has announced a new service to Sarasota, Florida. Starting in November, Elite Airways is adding two nonstop flights a week between Portland International Jetport and Sarasota Bradenton International. Elite President John Pearsall says the demand for Maine to Florida service has been consistently strong.
We believe that there's a strong network of folks who have homes both here in Portland and down in the Sarasota Bradenton area, and we believe that this will service not only them but vacationers throughout the year.
The flights will be on Thursdays and Sundays starting November 17th, with fares beginning at $199 each way. And now to the changes in energy use that we're all experiencing. New England now gets nearly 10% of its energy from renewable sources, with more on the way. The change is posing challenges for the region's electric grid and transforming the way our power is generated and shared. As part of Maine Public Radio's new collaborative reporting effort with other stations in the region, we take you to Vermont, where VPR's John Dillon visits a small member-owned utility.
Well, we got a couple outages going on. One is from a tree coming down, breaking a pole.
Inside the control room of the Vermont Electric Cooperative, operator Danny McMullen is keeping a close eye on screens that show the electrons flowing in and out of the co-op's northern Vermont territory.
And then we got another one with some underground faulty that crews are working on, hopefully to have restored, you know, latter part this forenoon. And so it's fairly quiet this morning, though, compared to what it can be at times.
It's cloudy and rainy this morning, so the instruments aren't showing much output from solar installations. Jeff Wright is the co-op's chief operating officer. He says there's one major benefit from solar power, at least in the summer.
It really does relieve pressure from the grid during the day when the system's peaking.
But during a recent sweltering week in August, Wright and the members of his co-op saw the limitations and the potential downside of solar generation. To understand what happened, you have to understand how power companies pay for their transmission costs. These prices are set annually and are pegged to how much the utility uses on that one time of the year when it draws the most electricity from the grid. Little swings in demand can make a big difference in transmission costs.
That swing for us could be $400,000-$600,000 just between those 2 days.
And that bill ultimately gets passed on to customers. So every power company pays obsessive attention to that day of peak use. They even ask customers to turn off appliances like dryers or dishwashers until the peak has passed. Solar systems can help offset that peak demand in the summer, but they did not help in Vermont during that hot week in August. The problem was it was sunny in Massachusetts, where solar arrays all over the state helped reduce the strain on the grid. But in Vermont, clouds and rain reduced the solar output, so Massachusetts will save on transmission costs for the year, while Vermont will not.
It's a really interesting push-pull, because when it's hot and it's sunny, it's nice to have less load to manage. But when you start to have those regional issues and one's doing a lot of generation, one's not, and you're starting to set your transmission costs based on your load allocation, it gets really volatile. And I think in the future that might become worse, but it's definitely something that nobody has really talked about yet.
Those discussions are starting to happen, triggered by a huge boom in solar in Vermont and across New England. In 2012, solar panels supplied 250 megawatts across the six-state region. This year, they'll deliver up to 1,600 megawatts, according to ISO New England, the regional grid operator. In 10 years, ISO expects that to more than double, to about 3,300 megawatts. But here's a challenge. Remember those screens the guys at Vermont Electric were looking at with power flowing across the grid? Grid operators can't see a lot of that solar generation. Marcia Blomberg, a spokeswoman for ISO, says much of the solar generation is what's called behind the meter. It's from rooftop panels or small arrays near houses.
Operating the power grid without being sure what those resources are going to be doing and how much consumers will be reducing their energy usage is the challenge.
Another challenge is the intermittent nature of solar power. Clouds that obscure the sun can drastically drop production from 1 second to the next. That means all of that solar power needs a backup source, primarily from natural gas generators.
If you can't see it and if you can't predict it, what you're forced to do is to run the grid more conservatively. And what that means in terms of air pollution and money is that you have power plants on standby.
Tom Dunn is CEO of Velco, which operates the transmission grid in Vermont. He says what's needed is more accurate weather forecasting. Velco has teamed up with IBM to use a supercomputer to produce precise weather forecasts down to 1 square kilometer. Dunn says knowing when the sun will shine and the wind will blow means the grid needs less of that natural gas power on standby.
When we have data, I think then we're in a place where we can comfortably make decisions to not make the infrastructure investment if it's not needed.
ISO New England has teamed up with Velco on a pilot project to improve forecasting for solar and wind generation. Dunn says more precise weather forecasting could save tens of millions of dollars annually because those standby generators wouldn't have to run so much in New England. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm John Dillon.
And in Bangor, fans of the Howard Johnson's restaurant have one final day to get their fill of clam strips, ice cream, and other favorite menu items. Today is the last day of operation for the city's Hojo's. After that, there will be only one left in Lake George, New York. In Bangor, the new owners have been talking about closing the restaurant for some time because of declining business. At one time, the orange-roofed eateries numbered more than 800. Waitress Kathy Jewett has been working at the Bangor restaurant since it opened in 1966. She says the closing is bittersweet. The Howard Johnson's Motel, meanwhile, remains open for business. And finally, here's meteorologist Paul Cousins with the forecast.
A summer pattern shows no signs of relenting, and at the same time, Hermine is slowly folding up south of Long Island. The overcast will expand and lower throughout all of Maine tonight. A few lonely sprinkles or misty moments near the ocean. Areas of dense fog, especially at the coastal edge. Very muggy and temperatures uniform, 60. Tomorrow, once the low clouds lift, we'll see a few spokes of sunshine throughout northern, western, and central counties. Overcast within 40 miles of the Gulf. A very humid day. Low 70s to low 80s. Coolest along the shore east of Portland. A warm front will lift through Maine Thursday. Purely tropical air will envelop us. A few showers will dart through northern and western Maine in the afternoon. Look for a mix of sun and clouds throughout the remainder of the state. Mid-70s north, upper 80s south, cooler at the coast. Friday will feature sizzling heat for most, partly sunny north, mostly sunny for a majority of the state, and it will still be sticky. 80 far north on the down east coast, low 90s south of Portland. Saturday looks to be the best day of the weekend. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for Maine Public Broadcasting.
And that's the news on This Day in Maine, Tuesday, September 6, 2016. Our theme music was composed by Robert Holt. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall, Susan Sharon, and Andrew Catalina. And to Steve Missler, Mal Leary, Fred Bever, John Dillon, Ed Morin, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes, or you can email us at tdim@mpbn.net. I'm Barbara Caridi. For all of us here at Maine Public Broadcasting, thanks for listening.